6'6" above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to place. And good afternoon. Welcome to this, the Thursday edition of A Public Affair. I'm your host for this hour. My name is Alan Ruff. I'm delighted today to have a special guest, really a good friend of mine, but a special guest regardless, Bob McChesney. Bob McChesney's in the studio with us today. Bob, for those of you not familiar, is a media reform activist and critic, professor in the Department of Communications at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. His work concentrates on the history and political economy of communications, an emphasis on the role of media played in our capitalist society. Bob McChesney has a particular interest in the state of journalism and the relationship of media systems and structures of effective self-governance. He's the co-founder of Free Press, the national media reform organization. Bob is also frequently writes with John Nichols and the monthly reviews, John Bellamy Foster, both of whom I've had on the air in the past. He's among the most widely read and honored communications scholar in the world today, really. And fortunately, we have Bob lives in Madison. And as a matter of fact, he was a host back when. I can't even remember. It was before I began this, well before I began this program, host of this program of APA, Public Affair. Bob, let's just wrap for a little bit about, because sure. Clearly you're, I don't think anyone understands better the importance of what we do here.
You know, I'm a huge believer in community radio, community broadcasting. You know, going back to Seattle when they had Crab in the 70s, which I was involved with there, the late, long gone Crab. And you really see the difference when you're in a community with a great community radio station and one that doesn't have one. And most American cities don't have a community radio station.
Our guest today, Bob McChesney. We're here today to talk about Bob's brand new book of Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. Bob, you start your new book with a discussion of what you call the two catechisms. The catechism regarding the way that our economy works, and the catechism in regard to how this media system operates. Talk about that, if you will.
Well, let me back up and say the reason I introduced the two catechisms is that there's a huge literature now about trying to understand the internet and the digital revolution and what it means. It's a popular literature to some extent. The books that are done by major publishing houses by people like Clay Shirky, Stephen Johnson, Yochai Benkler. And the books fall into basically two camps. And the camps are either the celebrants who are excited about the internet and the revolution it brings and the power of the digital communication changes, and the skeptics, the people who think that the celebrants are exaggerating its importance and there are negative consequences. And I wrote this book basically because I was dissatisfied with both camps. They both had interesting insights, but neither of them seemed to really have they were missing something very fundamental, and this book hopes to address that, which is they don't have much of a sense of capitalism. They don't have a political economy. They don't understand the relationship of digital technologies and the internet to a capitalist political economy. So the point of my book basically was to say, look, let's put it in the context of capitalism and then rethink all these interesting arguments and all this research out there and try to get a handle on it. And my argument is that when you understand it in terms of capitalism, then you can see how you can change it for the better. Then you can get a sense of what policies and institutions need to be changed in order to have a digital revolution that serves democracy and doesn't undermine democracy. So that's sort of the foundation that then leads into the problem, which is that both sides, the skeptics and the celebrants, have what I call a very mythological understanding of how capitalism works. I call it the catechism. And the catechism is something that probably most Americans heard about when they were in their crib. Their parents were leaning over telling them about the capitalism is based on buyers and sellers freely coming together in the marketplace, and the market is the most rational and perfect institution, and that the system works. And there might be a few minor problems along the way, but they'll be ironed out because you have economic growth and the system will change. And the role of a democracy is basically to make sure capitalism stays functional and to protect the interests of the market and property rights. And if it does that, only good things will ultimately happen. That doesn't mean you'll have a perfect world, but you'll have the best of all possible worlds. And that's the general catechism. But capitalism is part of the DNA of an advanced society. It's unalterable. It's unchangeable. It's just taken for granted, like the air you breathe. It's natural. And, you know, that's nonsense. And it's one of the great ironies I talk about in the book is that a society which is so immersed in capitalism, is such a total capitalist, a super capitalist society, has such completely half-assed ideas about it. I mean, it's preposterous. If we had the same understanding of football, people wouldn't even understand the forward pass. I mean, we have advanced understanding of football, but we have negligible, non-existent, ludicrous understanding of capitalism.
You're listening to Bob McChesney, who just commented on about these assumptions about capitalism and how it functions and really how the media system works under capitalism. We'll be discussing that shortly. And then, of course, Bob McChesney, there's there's a catechism about how the media system, how journalism functions.
Well, one of the problems with the notion of the free market being a magical system that solves all the problems is it doesn't really apply at all when you look at it closely, which I do in the book. I mean, it just has serious problems. So you have tremendous inequality built into it that makes a mockery of the idea that people come into the marketplace as equals. It has monopoly pressure built inside it. You have stagnation. You have commercialism, all sorts of factors that really undermine the quality of the system and the quality of life. But even for people who buy in completely to the catechism, it has no application to media or communication whatsoever. Even economists understand that it's a big sort of asterisk you have to put by all media systems. You can't use market principles. For example, for all entertainment media, for book publishing, the works, the free market doesn't work. It never has worked. And that's why they invented copyright. Copyright is a government-created monopoly privilege that is based on the understanding that if you didn't have the government set up monopoly rights to someone's book or their movie or their music, then it would be copied and no one would make any money and you wouldn't have a commercial marketplace. It requires government-created monopoly policies in order to have a commercial marketplace. So the traditional catechism of free markets solve all your problems doesn't work in media or communication. That's even the case in journalism, which is the one branch of communication that doesn't require copyrights, the one branch that doesn't use copyright that much. But journalism, you know, the problem with journalism is if you have your news media controlled by private commercial interest, they're going to use it to push their own advantage. And that makes a mockery then of what you need from a free press in a democratic society, because you'll have press barons pushing their agenda. And in a monopolistic market, there won't be much of a chance for anyone else to talk. So that's where we came up with the notion of professionalism in journalism. The whole principle of professionalism, which came up 100 years ago, was to protect the population from commercial control over journalism. That's its role to play. It's a frank recognition that commercial values and journalism don't mix.
And of course, it's flipped now. That is, journalism is driven, you know, this whole notion now of the non-news, the infotainment, the news as part of a bigger marketing, advertising, profit-making apparatus.
Well, that's been one of the great trends of commercial journalism. One of the reasons why it's anathema to journalism is that the idea of you're making money is you print whatever you can to make money, period. Whether it's entertainment, whether it's salacious, whether it's untrue, market pressures make you want to just make, print, publish, and do whatever makes the most amount of money. That's always been a crisis. And again, that's why you saw the birth of professionalism.
Bob, talk about you begin the book early on in the book, you talk about the utopian hope, the vision of what the internet was to be, that notion of the internet as a base of democratic renewal and improvement of society unencumbered by the values of the market.
Well, there's a whole host of books that are coming out simultaneous with Digital Disconnect by people like Stephen Johnson and others making the argument, which it's a pretty familiar argument now. The internet is it breaks down hierarchies. It allows people to communicate peer-to-peer. It allows there to be crowdsourcing so that tens of millions of people can combine their power. It empowers the masses so they can communicate with each other and not have to go through the bottlenecks created by elites. It can revolutionize virtually every institution in a democratic manner. And in the case of some people, like Yochai Benkler, he makes the argument that it really enables human beings to change their nature. It'll bring out our better angels and repress the demons of the Hobbesian world that have ruled us for centuries. So it's premised in the idea that the internet or digital technologies have an extraordinary trump card power, superpower, that ride roughshod over history and really set the course of history in a way that's very progressive and very positive.
But that hasn't been the case. The meat of your book goes into the fact that utopian vision's very omnipresent certainly in the early mid-90s has largely gone by the wayside.
Yes and no. I mean, as I said, there are still books being written right now that are acclaimed and embraced and will sell 100 times more copies of than Digital Disconnect, making exactly that argument. So no, it is not going away. I think that social media has supercharged it. I think, you know, Facebook and Twitter and smartphones has given that a whole new lease on life, that we're in this revolutionary period, and that this is a technology that cannot be repressed, and it's just the beginning, and it has nothing ultimately but really good things, and there's really nothing governments or bad people can do to get in the way of it. It's such a super powerful technology. That is not a discredited position. That's the mainstream position. That's the conventional wisdom, Alan.
Right. But you're taking issue with it.
Oh, yeah. It's completely baloney. But I didn't take it 20 years ago wasn't when that battle was fought. The battle's being fought right now.
Right.
We're in the middle of, you know, World War IV on this one. It's a ludicrous argument. God help us. If this is the result of the revolution is the world we're living in now, where would we be had the internet not been invented? It's hard to think. You know, I opened the book, for example. You might just the first paragraph in the preface is, you know, in the early 1970s, you and I are the same generation. I mean, I was of a cohort that thought that capitalism was seriously flawed and had to be replaced then. That there was too much inequality, too much militarism, too much commercialism, too much poverty, that it just struck me as a dead-end system then. Well, right now, the capitalism of 1972 looks awfully good. I mean, there's not a kid I teach in any of my classes who wouldn't give anything to have 1972 capitalism back. So if the internet's working miracles on our economy and on our society, well, I don't know what our economy and society look like if it didn't exist compared to 1972. We have 60% unemployment.
Bob, let's continue on with let's pick that apart. Go deeper with that. That is, you're saying that capitalist drives, the need for accumulation for profit, has really transformed and continues to transform the whole media system.
Yeah, I mean, I think, Alan, the way I'd put it is that capitalism has had a lot more influence on the internet than the internet's had on capitalism. I think, you know, that if we want to look at where what the independent variable is in that relationship, the communication technologies has changed a lot about all our lives dramatically. But, you know, capitalism has influenced the way they've changed them dramatically as well. And that's a lot of what my book's about. Even going back to the democracy point, which is the key point that these are democratizing technologies, you know, one does not need to be an expert in political theory to know that democracy requires a handful of things to be effective, a genuine adult suffrage democracy. And there's no debate on these points. One of them is that it can't have too much economic inequality. Inequality is cancer to democracy. You can have some, clearly, but you can't have huge inequality. So in the third world countries where 3% of the population are illiterate and own everything, no one ever expects them to be functional democracies with universal suffrage. That changes in more advanced economies, capitalist economies, but it's still a problem. And so you have a situation in the United States with tremendous and growing inequality where the bottom third of the population barely participates in politics compared to the top third. It's heavily skewed. And where our political system is completely dominated by the interests of the wealthy and corporations. And that is not a debatable point either. All the political science research that's come out in the last 2 years from our top political scientists, all of it, has basically said that our government, all the decisions made in it represent the interests of the top 1% or 2%. The bulk of the population has no influence at all. So the measure of the internet's democratizing potential is how does it deal with inequality? How does it deal with monopoly power? How does it deal with political corruption? Is it ending it? Is it undermining? Is it turning it around? Is it making us a more egalitarian society? Is it lessening the power of big business and corporations and blasting open the economy? Is it doing those things? And if it is, then I think you've got a credible argument political, economically. Okay, this is a force for progress. This is a force that's leading to a more democratic society. If it isn't doing those things, then I think it's an awfully difficult argument to make, or you're going on to some sort of new dimension we haven't had before to understand democracy.
Again, you, as a critic of this, the current state of the dominant media, are saying that, you know, you talk at length in the book about the moves of in every field imaginable of so-called communications, mass media, the internet among them, of increasing concentration of conglomerates and monopolization, and what that means.
Well, concentration's built into capitalism, and I've got some of the research in the book. I've done a lot of this with John Foster and other work we've done together. But the data is pretty clear. There are fewer firms that are bigger that dominate the economy today than 30 or 40 years ago. And it's sort of it seems to be the path. And one of the interesting questions is the internet changing that? Because the great economic hope of the internet in the 90s, and you still hear it today incredibly, was that it was going to end the power of large corporations because people would get information online. It would create all this price competition. The consumer would have all the power. And big corporations would be like so many dinosaurs because there would be plucky young entrepreneurs who come along and offer a better service and use the internet to reach potential prospective consumers. In fact, and I have a long chapter on this in the book, the data doesn't support that whatsoever. Now, that doesn't mean there aren't ways consumers have more power and certain to buy airline tickets or something. You can do it online, and there's all sorts of interesting stuff going on. But in general, what we've seen with the internet is it's accelerated monopoly power in our society like no other factor ever in human history. I mean, it's really quite extraordinary what we see at the internet, and now it's widely accepted, even among the, you know, in this is not a controversial point, but it's just not widely talked about. But the internet's basically created more monopolies than any other institution ever. And by monopoly, I don't mean you own control everything in a market. Even John D. Rockefeller Standard Oil didn't have 100% of the oil in the United States.
He wanted it, certainly.
Of course. Everyone wants 100% of the market, or they're not going to win in capitalism. Right. But if you've got over 50, 60, 70% of a market, you basically control the market. You can set your price easily. You can really keep any opponents out. And so generally for economists, monopoly is when you have control over prices. And when you've got 40, 50, 60, 70% of a market, you have an effective monopoly. And usually what we're seeing in almost every case in the internet is every industry quickly has gravitated to being a monopoly. A Google, a Microsoft, an Amazon, where there might be is you and there might be one or two other players in the market, but it's really you control it. And I go in depth in the book about why this is. It's part of it's just the natural stuff of capitalism. Big firms get bigger, and they have the ability to keep smaller firms out. And any rational capitalist wants to be a monopolist. You love competition for the textbooks, for the politicians, for the preachers to talk about it so they're blue in the face. And you want competition in every market you're dealing in as a consumer. But in your own market, you want to walk out the door and be the only one selling your product. And that's why all the great fortunes in American history, without exception, look at who's behind them. People pretty much have monopolies or close to monopolies.
Now part of the catechism, of course, of the orthodoxy is that monopolies when and where concentrations when and where they take place are in a sense natural in that they're the result of successful competition. But bring in, talk about the role of the state in this.
Well, the result of successful competition, I mean, the result of some firm kicking the butt of everyone else and being so large it can prevent anyone else from competing with it. But I mean, it's hardly like a football match, and so you can't take the Super Bowl title away from a team that beat all the competition because it doesn't eliminate the other 31 teams. You have another season the next year. The government plays a crucial role in all this. The government is basically sanctifies these firms, their monopolies. And, you know, most of the firms that dominate do so on the basis of government-funded subsidies of one form or another. Most of the developments online come from military research that were paid for by taxpayers that private firms then capitalize upon. And in the book, I go through a long list of examples of that, just about everything. And the firms, again, concede that. Again, this is not controversial. It's just not widely talked about. So you have these firms. Another crucial factor, Alan, though, is what's called network effects, which is why especially you see concentration online, which means that in the world of the internet, if you get to be number one, And you're the top one. Everyone has to use you or they get excluded. So you could buy books from someone besides Amazon if you want online. But Amazon has gotten so big, you're going to get, they have much bigger supply. They can get it to you much faster. And they can undercut the price of any potential competition if they have any threat. So everyone gravitates to Amazon, which makes it virtually impossible to start a second credible threat. Google search, similar situation. The list, that's true with everything.
Bob, let's continue on with that media monopoly, that role of the state. You discuss that at length throughout the book. You mentioned copyrights, but also the significance of patents today.
Well, patents are absolutely crucial because they're used now. But patents are like copyright. They're government-created monopoly privileges. And they're the original idea of patents, going back to the Constitution, because they're in the Constitution, was that you would give an inventor a 20-year monopoly over their invention so they could make money off it to give inventors incentive to produce new products and innovate, similar to copyright. Monopoly, government-created monopoly privilege. It's an anti-free market thing seen as necessary to encourage innovation and good for the economy. And in the Internet, what we've seen in the last 15 or 20 years is there's been a huge increase in the use of patents, a wild increase. I mean, there. You know, I have the data in the books. It's quite striking. A company like Microsoft might have done 200 patents, might have filed 200 patents in 10 years ago, and now it's doing 10 or 15,000 patents a year. There's a thicket of patents. And what this means is for the entrepreneurs who want to start a new business, you know, now they've got to go through a thicket of patent law before they can even launch their product for the most part, because they have to battle these firms that have all these patents they own. And are willing to go to court, and they've got lawyers ready to do it. And if you're an entrepreneur and you want to start a business, a small business, well, that's enough to get you, scare you away, and keep you out of it. It encourages and promotes monopoly. And even in the industry, there's a wide recognition this is disastrous for any sense of economic competition or innovation. It's purely to protect the entrenched players from new competition.
Again, it's getting back to the reality versus the line that's out there coming from conservatives, coming from the right, talking about, get the government out of our lives, get the government, that the government is the problem, the state is the problem. And it's clear that large firms couldn't, the entire economic history of the U.S., that large firms couldn't reach ascendancy, dominate markets without the state, without the government.
The best example is, and I have pretty much a whole chapter on this topic in the book, is with Internet service provision, which in America today has become a cartel. Basically, we have a cartel where you either get it from a broadband line, you're going to get from Comcast, the cable company, or one of the two or three companies that run cable in this country. They each have a local monopoly, but primarily Comcast, which also owns NBC. Or you're going to get a smartphone, and basically that means AT&T or Verizon, which have a duopoly in effect now, increasing a duopoly. So we've created this cartel for Internet access. And Americans, this is completely corrupt. This is all government-driven. None of these companies won anything in any free market competition. Their entire business model from the very beginning, going back to telephone and cable TV, was that they got monopoly licenses from the government. And basically, they had a government-created monopoly franchise for radio, for telephone and cable TV service. Well, now these companies have become the Internet service providers, and they charge us through the teeth to get Internet access, either through our cell phones or through a broadband line. And we have crappier service than virtually any other country in the world. We pay much more. And it's strictly because the government acknowledges and maintains this absurd cartel. In effect, there's no competition. So these companies are cleaning up. They're making a fortune at Verizon, Comcast, and AT&T, and we're getting screwed. And, you know, the parallels are very much to healthcare. It's not unlike our healthcare system, where Americans pay much more for a crappier service because there's this health insurance cartel that basically gouges us for a big chunk of money. And that's what we have in our ISPs. We have the worst service in the world, and we have much higher prices than anywhere else in the world. And we have a significant part of the population that still doesn't have access to broadband. And it's all because we've allowed the government has created and maintained these monopolists who basically run the FCC and own Congress when it comes to policy.
You're listening today to Bob McChesney, author of his latest book, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. We'll open up the phone lines. Let's go to our first caller. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yes, thank you. I recently read where Al Jazeera English had become subordinate to the Qatar government, and that many of their reporters, their journalists, left because of a bias. So my question has to do with editorial judgment and journalism in this country. How do we depend upon editorial judgment to fact-check and make sure that we're getting a good product on the Internet when we read our newspapers? Could you comment, please?
Well, I can't really comment on Al Jazeera, to be honest. I don't know enough about the situation to say anything intelligent. But what I can say is that the book, the longest chapter in the book, Chapter 6, deals precisely with what's happening to journalism on the Internet. And the title of the chapter is Journalism is Dead, Long Live Journalism. And it's there's no doubt that the journalism is in free fall, collapse, and disintegration in the United States today, and to a lesser extent varies all over the world. And the reason for that is that businesses no longer find it profitable to invest in journalism, and they're discontinuing it. We have far fewer working journalists per capita today than we had 20, 25 years ago, probably about 40% roughly, as many as we did. And we're still in free fall, collapse. And the reason for that is often attributed to the Internet, because Craigslist took so much of the money away. People no longer buy newspapers or magazines. They are going to go online. And there's an element of truth to that. The problem with that argument is that the collapse of journalism started in the 80s. The loss of resources, even when they were swimming in profits, and Google wasn't invented yet, the World Wide Web wasn't invented. And it accelerated in the 90s when the Internet was taking no business away from the news media. It was really a capitalist thing. They basically could make more money by gutting the product, and then they just kept gutting away until there wasn't much left. But the Internet basically speeded up the process and made it worse. And one of the great arguments about the Internet is that it is going to rejuvenate journalism. One argument is, well, with Twitter and Facebook, we don't need journalism because we can talk to each other, so who needs journalists? And they say, look at the Arab Spring, look at the Occupy movement, but people were tweeting each other. They don't need to actually know anything else but what they tweet each other. And I think, just by the way I phrased that last sentence, what an absurd comment that is. And that you need people who are covering communities in independent newsrooms, with fact checkers, with editors who are competing with other newsrooms. So if someone misses a story, there's a chance someone can get it. Monopoly is the enemy of free press, be it commercial or non-commercial. And what we have increasingly in the United States is hardly any journalism left whatsoever. And the bad news, and this isn't talked about a lot right now, there was a hope for a long time that advertising would come to support all entertainment and media online as well as journalism. That would be the source of revenues to keep it going. And the great change, and I talk about this at length in the book, that hasn't really been discussed much elsewhere in advertising, is as we go to online advertising, the tradition of advertisers just supporting a magazine or a newspaper or a website, and then the magazine, newspaper, or now website would take that money to subsidize their content, their journalism, or their music, or whatever, that type of advertising is disappearing rapidly. It no longer exists. When a company wants to advertise online, they go to AOL or Google or Microsoft, one of these huge ad networks, and they say, we want to buy 2 million men, 18 to 24, with college educations or in college, who might be interested in buying an automobile. And they will basically get 2 million impressions on the web to those people, no matter what website they're at. It doesn't, and the actual news, the website hardly gets any money off of that deal at all. It goes to these networks because basically they've had the ability now to track you, so they don't need to go to a website to get you. They can get you wherever website you go to, and that's what's happening. And because of that, advertising no longer is supporting content. All it's doing is really increasing invasions of your privacy online. It's a dramatic change in the history of advertising, and it's dreadful in terms of looking to advertising for any sort of resource base for media content or journalism.
You're listening to Bob McChesney, a longtime friend of and supporter of WORT. We're talking about his new book today, Digital Disconnect, How Capitalism is Turning the Internet Against Democracy. A caller wants to know what he thinks of Better Angels of Our Nature.
Oh, I was referring to Yochai Benkler's argument that the Internet can spur better angels of our nature, change human nature. Well, I think there's a lot of truth to that. But I don't think you're going to do it. I think you've got to change capitalism if you want to really change our nature. I don't think you can have a dog-eat-dog society or, like we have, and expect our nature to change magic.
Bob, talk about how that surveillance, if you will, that that marketing mechanism, keeping track on what people, where people go on the internet and what they listen to and what they read, how that spills over into for use by the national security state.
Well, yeah, absolutely. But the first thing to understand is that the way the internet has evolved since the 90s, with the development of a number of components, one of which is called cookies, basically everything you go online, you can be tracked, and they have records of you. And I go into detail in the book of the records that are kept of all users on the internet. It is driven commercially. It's driven basically so, I mean, the great line is about the internet is if you get a product for free, you're not the customer, you're the product. If you're getting something for free on the internet, you're the, you know, they're selling you to someone else. Google makes its money by selling the information it has about you. Facebook makes its money by selling the information it collects about you. Everything you do on a Google-related product, they collect, coordinate, they know everything about you, basically, everything you go to. Gmail, the works. Same thing with Facebook. Right on down, Amazon, the works. Everyone does that, and they collect all this information. It's an enormous amount of information. And I think people who study this closely say basically anything you do online, you should assume that there are commercial interests that have it. Lots of them, and they know everything about you. For the most part, they don't connect it to your name. That's not always the case. For the most part, your name, but everything else they know about. That's why they can track you with ads so easily now, and it's only going to get more extreme in coming times. So that's driven by commercial interests. But this is the same technology can be used by the government, by national security, and they have a great interest in this. The government has created cyberspace as one of its spheres of command. Like there's Africa, Asia, Europe, cyberspace. That's how serious it is in the Pentagon. It's got its own area of the world. It's like a continent. And they use the same technology to track people online, to follow them. I mean, anything you do, again, on your smartphone, they've got it all. I mean, you just got to understand that. Anything that, and so they can have access to that too and use it. And what we see, and this is, I think, the most important thing, and this is where it goes against that. In the catechism, the government and business are supposed to be at loggerheads. And that's how we always hear, yeah, government's getting in the way of business. Yeah. That's, you know, that is such nonsense. I mean, government gets in the way of business periodically when people rise up and demand things like minimum wage increase, then government's interfering in business. But what government does primarily in this area, it's just crystal clear, is it works very closely with business. I mean, the largest Google, Apple, Microsoft, all these companies, the largest companies, Comcast, AT&T, Verizon, have a very close and extraordinarily incestuous relationship with the national security agencies and with the government working together. It's not an antagonistic relationship at all. They scratch each other's backs. And it leads to some very troubling, I mean, there's stuff that's come out. I mean, I could go on and on, but you know, just last year, it came out how much AT&T and Verizon have been spying on their customers and turning the data over to the government. Google has done the same thing. Facebook, I mean, literally in the millions, the number of times these incidents take place. And this, people never know about it. They're not allowed to be told about it, in fact.
There's at one point in your book, you mentioned the fact that on a daily basis, there's an estimated 30,000 people that, for their jobs, do nothing but listen.
Yeah, there's a huge. There's more data that's top secret in this country now than there is that's public knowledge. More information is secret than public that's created on a daily basis, and so we're in this situation where you know the classical defense of capitalism and democracy, and Milton Friedman made it eloquently, was that the reason why capitalism was the most democratic economic system was that the political power was separated from the economic power. So you had sort of a division of power, and then the economic power was competitive so that there was constant flux there. And you never could have concentrated power that could have arbitrary control over people's lives. That was the defense of capitalism as being democratic. And now what we have is a situation where capitalism is dominated by a handful of monopolies who are completely in bed with the government, entirely corrupt system where they control the game, member of the population has very little involvement. And the fact is that by classic definitions of scholars, that's how you describe fascism. Fascism is a society where the government and large corporate interests worked hand in hand, and the government emphasizes making the firms profitable, propaganda, secrecy, all that sort of stuff, and the companies make a killing.
You know, recently, as an example of what you're talking about, doing research for a series of articles that I've been working on, I went to, I believe it was a Department of Defense public website. And then suddenly on Google and Facebook, off on the margin, I got ads appearing for either military recruitment or right-wing veterans organizations, support the troops kind of stuff, and so on. You know, presto, almost instantaneously, and I thought, okay, yeah, here's the pitch. This wedding of it's really the essence now of the so-called military-industrial complex.
And I think really what happens, and this is leads into the penultimate chapter of the book, you know, there's the defense we're supposed to have in our constitutional system from that taking place, and it was consciously put in there for that reason in 1787 to 1789, was that you'd have a press system. The job of the press system, in theory, in our constitutional system, is to monitor large private interests in the government, especially from military matters, to prevent them from acting in ways that are damaging to the general population and the constitutional freedoms we have. That's the theory. And that's why what's happened with journalism online is such an appalling situation. It's completely non-existent as a factor that's going to shed light and expose these relationships and, frankly, make it impossible for them to continue to exist. And that's really the crisis we have of our times right now, is that we have a journalism crisis that's aggravated by the Internet. That means that the ability for citizens to comprehend and understand and be aware of what's taking place with these large firms in the government is far less. I mean, you can go to stations like this, and you'll hear a discussion of it on this show every Thursday. You can get it on Democracy Now. You will get it periodically with Glenn Greenwald at The Guardian online. But, you know, you aren't getting a lot of it. And the fact of the matter is, it's not just talking about it. It's not just coming, man, the Pentagon sucks, man. We need our journalists to actually do research, who cover stuff, who get out and do the digging, like Nick Turst does, like you do when you work in Kazakhstan. And that costs money. That takes resources. And that's something that we haven't figured out as a society.
You know, we do have one caller. We got about 5 minutes left, and we want to get this caller in with a question or comment for Bob McChesney. Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. You talked a little bit, Bob, about the effects of the Internet on the consumer of products. Maybe you could just speak just for a minute on the effect of the Internet as consumers, as voters. What, you know, how do we spend our vote, and that's effect on the democratic process of elections. So I'll just take my comments off the air.
Thank you, caller.
That's an awesome question. And, in fact, I talk almost nothing about that in the book for a very specific reason, which is John Nichols and I are just right now finishing a book on that exact topic, so I didn't want there to be any overlap. The book's called Dollarocracy, and it deals with the money influx in our elections and the terrible media coverage of elections we have. But a lot of it is work on the Internet and how, you know, the great hope was that the Internet would undermine the power of big money, it would undermine gerrymandering, it would undermine corruption, and it would empower citizens so they could win elections, it could help dissident candidates have a chance who didn't in the old bad old days. It was going to slay the two-party system, it was going to slay the power of big money. And, you know, there might be instances where the Internet has done wonderful things. I think Arab Spring, it gets a certain amount of the credit. I think the uprising here in Madison, it gets a certain amount of the credit. But, unfortunately, what we're seeing with elections and the research we've done from 2012 is the Internet's being quickly incorporated into the sort of what we call the money and media election complex. And they're using that power to guess all sorts of information about people and manipulate people to get their votes. And the champion of this by far was the Obama administration. It's astonishing how much data they collected. In fact, people in Madison Avenue and Silicon Valley were hiring the Obama team after the election because they were so impressed that they were collecting data on every single American and learning what sort of messages you could use to get their votes, how you get friends to contact them through social media. Extraordinarily sophisticated manipulation. But even anyone who stands back and looks at it says even Orwell couldn't have imagined this sort of manipulation.
So a kind of perfection, if you will, of what critics here in the 60s first referred to as the corporate state, this wedding of, you know, politics, of the electoral process, the diminution of democracy, and the really the hegemony of this corporate form.
But specifically in the case of these political campaigns, what's very frightening is that one candidate can send out a message to a separate message to every single voter. And so they can basically create whatever they want to create. There's no accountability. And the greatness of the internet at one time, 20 years ago, was you couldn't lie. If you tried to lie, you'd catch up with you because it'd be up online. Well, now you can lie because you can send specific messages to specific people.
I want to thank our engineer sitting in today, Steve Meixel.